Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Joining me this week is Matt Fair, data science lead at Peapod Digital Labs. Matt, welcome to the show.
Great to be on. Very excited about this. I've loved the episodes of the show I've heard so far and glad to be part of it.
Excellent. Well, tell me way back in the day, what got you originally excited about computers or data science or maybe possibly being in the field one day?
Yeah, I would say that my background is probably the least conventional that I've found in the tech industry. So where I grew up was actually in very rural Western Maine in the mountains. And I definitely did not use computers growing up. I think while a lot of my peers were spending time learning how to set up different configurations on the computer, learning some code, I was much more hunting and fishing. So it was certainly not the standard background. But then I ended up going to the University of Southern Maine, knew really nothing about how the university system functioned or how to go about that. But I knew that I was really excited about the opportunity to get a degree and go to college. So I chose business almost just as a default. And while I was studying there, I took a couple of required stats classes and I really enjoyed them. But I didn't really ever see it as something I would be interested in as a career. It was just an interesting subject I needed to learn for my degree. Then I ended up taking a business statistics class. And from the first class, it was very clear that this was going to be much different from any of the other technical or statistics courses I had had. The professor was really, he certainly to this day, probably the best professor who I've had. And on day one, instead of talking about the algorithms we would be learning, about the refreshers for some of the algebra, some of the previous statistics that we should have taken, we spent the entire class just talking about cool applications of statistics in the world. So this was back right after the H1N1, the swine flu pandemic. And I very clearly remember the pivotal moment that led to everything I've done in my career up until now. He was talking about how the CDC was struggling to track the spread of H1N1. The reason being is that by the time someone had symptoms, went to a doctor, got a test, and then got a positive result back, there was maybe a 2 or 3 week lag. And they, at that point, were too far behind to take any reactionary measures. So what they did was they partnered with Google and they built a bunch of machine learning models to take the trends of search queries and determine from the search queries where breakouts were happening. They were able to get those models very accurate and were able to predict pretty near real time where breakouts were happening. And that gave the CDC the information they needed to be able to react to the spread of H1N1. And while we were going through that, it was the first time the dots ever sort of connected in my mind that, wow, this isn't just this somewhat interesting theoretical process of how probability in the world works. This is actually showing how powerful this is and the fact that you can make real world change using algorithms, using equations. From there, I really just became somewhat obsessed. I really, really dove into the statistics. I bought books on it. I took all the courses that I could. I took some of the MOOC type courses and I taught myself how to code in R and took on some side projects there. The internships that I took were statistical internships. Then when I completed my degree, I ended up getting a job at the university actually as a statistician and just really, really loved that field. I would say the rest is pretty much history. The coding, I really enjoyed that. I would say I enjoy it 90% of as much as I like the algorithms. But that's led me into some moonlighting as a app developer, working a few freelance jobs, developing for web and mobile, and a bunch of side projects that have really gotten me into full nerd mode of the development.
Yeah, you'd think that your background would be very unique, but we've had other folks on here who were bartenders before they got into software development, you know, completely off the grid. And a lot of folks are like, oh, I don't know if I could ever do it, but you did the most important part. Take that first step, learn a little bit of it, figure out, all right, is there a way with an internship or making myself available at a low cost to get experience? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the next thing you know, you start getting people demanding your services.
Yeah, I joke around because the second strongest skill I have with the most experience after data science was I worked in my hometown and then throughout university as a butcher. So I say, if Leonard Susskind can be what he is coming from the background of a plumber, then I can do something kind of interesting coming from a background of a butcher.
I have to be careful or we're going to spend 2 hours talking about meat primals and barbecue and so forth.
I'm a little sad I wasn't involved in the barbecue discussions.
Well, there's always future bonus episodes.
Exactly.
So after university, then what did you do?
Yeah, so after that, I ended up working with that job I did not that long, maybe 7 months or so, where I was working in that statistician role with the University of Southern Maine. Beyond that, I did have a little bit of a detour where I went through one of those kind of fast-track training programs for management where I would go and work in different parts of a company. So work in operations, work with finance, work with marketing. That wasn't really for me, but I'm glad that I did it because at that point, pretty much all of the professional experience I had had was related to data science, development, statistics in some sense. So I'm glad that I did have that introduction into the applied business because it taught me a lot about how companies function. But it also, I think, taught me a lot about what I don't want to do and what does not excite me as much. And so from there, I also did a lot of personal side projects where I would develop R libraries. I would learn new coding languages. So I got really into Swift for a while and developed some mobile applications. I still really like that. I've gotten back into that a bit recently. It's changed quite a bit, though, because now I'm working with Swift UI, which is a very new technology, significantly different to how I would develop in Swift before. And yeah, the handful of freelance jobs that I've had, working as business analyst, working in data science roles. And then for the last year, being at Peapod Digital Labs and building this new competency inside of that organization has been really probably the coolest experience I've had in my career so far.
Yeah. Tell me about Peapod Digital Labs. What are they up to and how do they kind of relate to their parent company and so forth?
It can take a little bit to wrap your head around the organizational structure we have here. But Peapod Digital Labs is an organization that serves as the e-commerce engine inside of Ahold Delhaize. So particularly Ahold Delhaize USA. And we partner with the brands that are in Ahold Delhaize USA to build the technology they need to stand up their e-commerce, their web, and their mobile. And the Peapod Digital Labs organization itself is somewhat new. But within that organization and the broader Ahold Delhaize USA, the competency of data science is certainly a new field. So when we first did this up inside of Peapod Digital Labs, we knew the odds were somewhat against us. And we also didn't know for sure that it was going to be successful. So we ended up launching this team as a proof of concept, really, with myself as the only member of it, to see if we could deliver at-scale recommendations in real time. And we ended up focusing on recommendation and personalization. Our bread and butter in the department is recommendation engines and personalization algorithms. So I have been leading that team for a little bit over a year now.
So is that the power behind like, hey, you bought peanut butter, you might also want jelly or?
Exactly. Anytime that a user interacts with the application, we are trying to give them the most personalized, seamless experience that we can. So what you're saying about having these complementary products, saying that customers like you also liked this, or because we know that you have bought these things, we think you will also like this item. That's definitely at the heart of what we're doing. But it goes also much broader than that. We're also working pretty heavily with some NLP to build out custom language models for our search and for our ability to model exactly what the utility of items are and what attributes of items actually make a difference. So being able to understand that this recipe has all of these items. And from that, it is probably a spicy recipe that maybe is Mexican cuisine and is not traditional, but falls under these subcategories of this food. So it's really been a pretty broad spectrum that we've worked on to be able to serve up recommendation. But you're absolutely right. That is the core of what we're doing, is personalizing every touch point.
Are there any surprising insights or things that you found while you were looking at the data or trying to figure out how to make better recommendations based on their language?
Yes, there have certainly been quite a few unexpected patterns. But one of the most interesting ones, I think, is the reverse engineering of finding patterns that appear like, what is that when we're spot checking something? And then going and searching what those items are. So, for example, we found that pasta shells are quite often sold with taco seasonings and shredded cheese and a bunch of items that we didn't really associate with pasta. And then we found out that there was a trending recipe on all recipes for making spicy Mexican taco shells, where they basically would take the burrito ingredients and put them inside of pasta shells. And there's been a lot of things like that that have been very interesting. But also just finding out things around the dynamic of how people interact with food. So understanding that for a lot of customers, brands are very important. But for any customer where brand is very important to them as their primary driver of purchasing an item, that's very category specific. So somebody will potentially never change their brand of toothpaste. And if they always get whitening toothpaste from Colgate, then if that's out, they will want a different type of Colgate toothpaste. They won't want a different brand of whitening toothpaste. But also finding out that that relationship doesn't hold up across categories. So in maybe the deli department, that's not a thing at all. So a lot of stuff where we're looking at it and trying to apply our ways that we shop and our ways that we assume things work into creating our hypotheses around how we will best model things. And then finding out that those aren't true has been really interesting.
I've personally experienced the social media driving recipe execution with my daughters. Mm-hmm. They found something where it was like feta cheese melted over red sauce and pasta. And they're like, do you want to try it? I'm like, no, it sounds terrible. Like, I don't like feta and I definitely don't like it melted over pasta. And they were all fired up because it was on Pinterest and Instagram and TikTok all at the same time. I wonder if you guys scraped those, if you could predict what you were about to spike in sales.
Yeah, definitely something we would love to do in the future. Getting our heads around recipes is surprisingly much more complex from an algorithm standpoint than you might assume. But it's something that we're actively working on. And actually a former guest of your podcast and a really brilliant guy, Russ Wilcox. So he's working on the team as well. And his specialty with us has really been around the NLP and coming up with these custom models to be able to find better relationships between products and get intent and be able to model the entities of different products and also text from recipes.
Now, do you guys ever have external folks test your algorithms and your AI that you've come up with to see if it's valid, or do you do it all internally? How does that work?
So we won't outsource the actual testing of what we build. But for one example, so when we were standing this up, we focused mostly on the data, the architecture, getting the infrastructure into the right place. And for the first 6 months of standing up the department, I would say maybe 25 to 30% of the work was actually around the research and development of the algorithm. And the remainder of it was standing up the right tools to be able to serve this at scale. So we were certainly concerned that when we launched this algorithm and we put it out into the wild, that it wouldn't perform the way we expected it to. And what we did was we actually took a third-party vendor who really is an expert in the industry and already had a similar algorithm to what we were trying to serve up. And we had their algorithm split tested against ours so that we can measure the performance. So we named our KPIs that we were looking for to drive change with. And we launched this A/B test at the end of this 6 months. To be honest, I entirely thought that this was going to fail. I knew that we had good logic, good theory. We had put a lot of thought into the algorithm. But first time getting something out there, and also the inability to test this type of algorithm without it being live, makes it really an experiment when you launch it. But fortunately, the first round of the algorithm performed honestly very similar to this third-party vendor. And a future A/B test that we launched probably 3 weeks later actually significantly outperformed them in a couple of the KPIs that we were trying to drive with this. So at that point, we had kind of our first checkbox, like, all right, we're doing something right.
It seems almost like you guys are like an AI or ML startup within a much larger company. Is that the kind of look and feel day to day?
It definitely is. So within Peapod Digital Labs, we're a reasonably large organization. But I think being such a new organization within the broader company, and also being a very tech-focused organization, in general, it shares a lot of similarities to working in a startup. Our team specifically, where we're this kind of weird island that's doing something totally different from what a lot of the rest of the company is doing, and that we have a lot of people on the team who come from startup backgrounds, from really techie backgrounds, it really has been a similar culture and just way of working and feel to some of the startups that I've collaborated with in the past, which honestly, I like a lot. There's not the risk that a major market force is going to put us all out of a job, but we still get a lot of that velocity and the autonomy that you get in a startup.
The nimbleness.
Exactly. That's a good word. I like that.
So we talked a bit in the pre-call about the novel approaches to NLP and association rule mining you guys were using.
So as we've stood up this team, I think the two things that have made it the most interesting to me and why I'd say this is one of the most exciting things I've done in my career is that first is that we are a new competency within the organization. But the second is that within food retail, this really is not a mature space for machine learning and artificial intelligence. So particularly within recommendation, a little bit more mature in the supply chain and product assortment and whatnot. But within recommendation, it's very new. So as we're trying to build out a recommendation engine, we can't go read a Medium article about how this is done at Spotify. We need to be able to model our very different dynamic of items, where they're low ticket items that are continually purchased over and over again. And we find that, you know, your average shop, if you have, let's say, 30, 40 items in it, that's very different from the way that you have the sequential nature of Spotify or Netflix, or the way an Amazon would model their items where you don't have regular recurring purchases. So that has led us to dig through the academic literature, dig through the industry publications, and find that really not much has been written about this. So we're building a lot of what we're doing from scratch, and we are developing novel algorithms to be able to solve these problems, which of course makes it a lot slower than if you could just load up a pre-made Python library and flow your data into it. But it also makes it a lot more interesting because we really are needing to apply the scientific method a lot more, I would say, where we have a hypothesis of how we believe this data is behaving. We build our own model to capture that. And then we test it and see if that's actually what's happening.
So what sort of tools are you working with? What's the technology stack you guys are using?
Internally, everything that we're using is within the Azure ecosystem. And inside of that, we really have a broad array of tools that are at our disposal for this. In the beginning, we were really leveraging PySpark for the majority of our model pipelines. The reason being, we're working with fairly large data, and we needed to train things that could really be lent to more traditional types of machine learning that were good inside of PySpark ML and good inside of MLlib. So we leveraged that a lot for our model training. Then the outputs that would come from that would go to a couple different places. If they needed to be high availability in serving our production endpoints, then we would move them into a Mongo database. We use Mongo database or the Mongo API via Azure's Cosmos production database. And that allows us some reasonably good flexibility and a lot of speed to be able to leverage the database at the time of making an inference and returning a set of recommendations. For building out our endpoints themselves, that has been an interesting journey. We have used mostly serverless technology up to here, where we use Azure Functions as a shell to provide some of the logic. But for people who are familiar with Azure Functions or with AWS, Lambda would be the equivalent, where you have these serverless technologies that are serving your endpoint. They aren't as flexible as you might want them to be. Particularly, they don't play well with any in-memory objects. So with some of our algorithms, we really need to do subsets very, very quickly. So we need to be able to take maybe a million arrays and test if those arrays are a subset of maybe the items in a basket. And doing that within Mongo is not feasible because you get this more than exponential time complexity as you add additional items. But doing that with a tree search in memory is very feasible. So we can write out our tree data structures, hold them in memory, search them in milliseconds, and then only fetch the resulting records from Mongo. And now we're trying to make a migration to a technology that will let us hold that in. We're trying a few different things. We're working with Azure Kubernetes right now, so AKS, and trying a few different approaches to hold objects in memory.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
How well would you say Azure gave you turnkey solutions versus you really felt like you were hand-rolling pieces of it?
I would say Azure does a good job pitching things as they're going to be turnkey solutions. So they've got a lot of really great, I guess, boilerplate things for us to be able to turn on. So if we need a SQL database, if we need a cluster of something, it's fairly easy to stand that up. What we find is that particularly for our use cases, which in large part is probably due to the novel nature of what we're developing, we find that we spend a lot of time on the configuration and optimization of these tools and of the connecting them. Now, this is certainly less my area of expertise. I'm more on the algorithm side. But within my team, within the data science team, we do have an engineering function. So those people, our engineers, are awesome, way smarter than I am. And I know that they have spent a significant amount of time working on getting these just right for us.
Yeah, we spoke to a previous guest on Underserved, Jeremy Halperin, and he had mentioned when they were baking off Google Cloud Platform versus AWS that Google did a better job of pitching you a solution as opposed to AWS is like, we have DNS and we have this and we have that, and like giving you very specific technical tools. And then, all right, you can go build something with it.
Yeah. The AWS one, I think, is funny is the names that they use for it. What is their app hosting? I think it's like Electric Beanstalk.
Yes.
Like the names are not related to what the tool like, actually
is. I think
does.
Route 53 is their DNS or something. It's like, okay.
Yeah. The one that honestly I think I've liked the best that I've worked with in some other companies in the past, which is probably better fit for a startup, but I've really enjoyed Heroku in the past. They, in my experience, have been the best for that turnkey solution. You need an instance stood up, very easy to go, turn something on and have limited code, but also allows the flexibility for you to add startup scripts and modify it as needed. So for any listeners who are doing a startup and are considering between AWS, Azure, Google Cloud Platform, it might be worth looking into Heroku as well.
Now, did you guys go serverless because you don't want to spend money on 720 hours a month or whatever it is in order to have servers stood up all the time and things are going to spike when you are actually doing the processing versus at rest?
Yeah, so these decisions were weighed in by people who know a lot more about this than myself. My understanding is we made these decisions for a couple different reasons. The top one being time to launch. It was fairly fast and easy to stand these up and get them ready and production ready very quickly. Another, I think, decision is that while we were prototyping these and developing a lot of the endpoint logic, we were using Flask just locally in the department to be able to write and very quickly test our deployment logic. Whereas in using Azure Functions, using these serverless technologies, migrating that code and that logic from what we had written in Flask or just written locally in scripts was very straightforward. The application of it was very similar. Those were probably the big reasons, more so than cost.
Okay. Now, I got to imagine you guys are probably growing pretty quickly. What sort of folks are you hiring into your organization?
We certainly are. So it started out just myself, and then my first hire was a senior machine learning engineer, and now we have quite a bit of headcount on the team. And we are going to continue to grow. So the way that our team is structured right now is we're broken into three sub-teams. And the sub-teams are NLP, because NLP really has taken on a major role in what we're doing and our ability to personalize recommendations. And the second is core recommendation, which is probably what people think about when they think about recommendation engines. So doing matrix factorization type models, collaborative filtering, predicting sequences of things, association rule mining, that type of work. The third is continuous improvement. The continuous improvement part of the department is entirely focused on taking what we've already got out there and making it smarter. So that is a lot of applied statistics, setting up our A-B test, making sure that we're measuring things in a way that isn't biased and we're getting the best results back. And then applied across those three functions, partner with our engineers. So we have machine learning engineers, data engineers, and then we call them software engineers, more kind of cloud ops, cloud computing engineers. And across all of those, we are going to continue to grow the team. So we're really looking for some smart data scientists, some smart machine learners, and a really broad spectrum of engineering abilities.
How distributed is your team? Are your folks mostly in the Northeast? Or are you across the states or across the world? Or
Yeah, so right now, we have members in a few different areas. So I am generally based out of Boston, but recently have been located in Charlotte, North Carolina. I would say the majority of our team is in Boston, but we also have an office in Chicago. So we've got some members out there. And then we've got a handful of members who are in different locations.
Now, do you guys hire full-time for everything, or do you guys outsource any of the development or data science work that you do?
So we don't outsource in the sense of giving a piece of software or an algorithm to a third party to develop, because that really is our core competency, and that is the IP we want to be developing internally. But we do work with contractors. We do hire direct to full-time employees on the team, but we also collaborate with some contractors, and we've had really good success with the contract to permanent approach, because that way we can really have some velocity of bringing on some smart people quickly. And then at the end of a period of time, they join our team full-time.
Very good. We've done that with a lot of our clients. I've seen a change lately. It used to be it was like either or. Either someone wanted permanent employment or someone wanted contract employment, and never the two did mix. And Now you're seeing more people on both sides, the organizations and the developers, kind of a try before you buy sort of approach.
Yeah, I think before I started doing this, I would have thought it was really just benefiting the company. But thinking about it, if I were to go try to maybe change industries or wanted to get into a different field of work, I think I would definitely take that approach, because that allows you to really quickly work with a company and have quick velocity and sort of prove your worth without needing to go through all the rigor that companies might put you through for a full-time employee, but then makes it easy to transition full-time if that's what you want at the end.
So having been on both sides of the interview table yourself, do you have any advice for folks that are interviewing for like an AI or ML type position?
Absolutely. I could go on for quite a while about this, but I'll keep it brief. So over the course of the last year, I hope I'm not exaggerating, but I think I've probably done 80 to 100 interviews as we've been growing this team. And I obviously in my career have done a lot of interviewing. So I think I've seen a lot of trends that can probably be helpful to people who are interviewing for these types of roles. The number one thing I think that I would say is a lot of people, and even very competent people, will sort of get into the habit of coming into the interview and listing the skills that they know in a very buzzwordy way. And even if they really know that, it's their attempt at self-promoting and is entirely understandable. But from the interviewer's point of view, it makes it really challenging to determine what they know and what they don't know. It's like when you see a resume that lists out 75 different skills and you're like, okay, well, which ones are you actually good at versus which ones have you read a quick tutorial on? And what I think is a much better alternative is to share experiences and explain how you applied that skill. So for example, it's very common to be in an interview where somebody says, oh yeah, I've worked with XGBoost, because that's one of the more popular packages for being able to train regression or classification algorithms right now. And it's very accurate and it's a really good package. But everybody says that they have that experience. If somebody says that to me, I can't quite parse out how good they are with it. So they say, I know XGBoost and I know how to do grid search. It's much more powerful if they say, our business had this problem that they were trying to solve, and we needed to be able to maybe predict the time that it takes for an order to arrive. So I started by taking all of the data and saying, I think these things here will be related to the time it takes for an order to arrive. I put those features into a data frame, and then I train to predict the amount of time it'll take to arrive. When I trained it for the first time using XGBoost, I realized that these goodness of fit metrics were X, Y, and Z, and that wasn't good enough. So I took that as an indicator I needed to improve my features. I did some additional feature selection, feature engineering, tweaked that a little bit, and I realized that now we're starting to find some patterns. From there, I knew that I needed to improve the model better because it wasn't good enough, but we're starting to get some signal. So I went and I read some industry papers on how people have approached this in the past and what ranges of hyperparameters they've used and XYZ. So then I took those, I added that into a grid, I ran grid search, and after enough tuning, I was able to get it to a place where it was as accurate as I needed it to be. When someone says something like that, I very much now understand what their experience and their level of competency is. It's significantly more powerful.
I think telling stories and showing that you have not just knowledge of some keywords and syntax, but understanding of why, how you apply this, what to do if things go wrong, et cetera. And I think your story earlier where you talked about how you're kind of a tinkerer on your own time and like to, you know, do side projects and build things. I think letting that come across, if that's part of who you are, is a big thing to helping folks understand that you really love this stuff, that you'd probably be doing this even if you weren't doing it for a living.
Very much agreed. That's actually a really great point. If you can communicate that, it's going to go a long way. If you sound like, I'm in this job because it has the salary I wanted and I just got a degree in it, so I guess I'll do this. That, even if you really have the technical skills, it's going to be a lot harder to make that higher than if maybe you have lesser technical skills, but you really are passionate about it and you can tell that this is what this person wants to be doing. That makes it a lot easier to make the decision to offer a job to that person. The one other thing I'd say going into an interview is avoid interviews that don't do a technical assessment or a coding test. It's understandable that it seems stressful. It's kind of feels like it's high stakes and it's just an annoyance to go through. But in my experience, places that don't do coding tests, they aren't vetting their candidates as well as they could be. A lot of times it's an indicator that the person leading the team isn't technically versed, so isn't able to administer those types of technical assessments. And also, it really is a great opportunity for you to showcase your skills. A lot of times the technical test is what really says, okay, I wasn't sure about the phone screen or the first interview, but they crushed it here, so we definitely want this person on.
So, okay, they've had a few jobs in data science and machine learning and so forth. What other advice do you have for folks throughout their career in the field?
I mean, I would say for general career advice, stay curious. There's that saying where if you know how to use a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I would say learn new technology, learn new tools, learn new ways of doing things. If you know how to solve a problem really well with maybe regression models or particular machine learning models, but you don't know how to use deep learning, maybe learn that. If you know how to code really well in R, but you haven't worked in Python or vice versa, I'd recommend learning the other. Staying up to date is a big one. And then put yourself in professional situations where you're surrounded by people who are smarter and more accomplished in the field than you are. Their motivation will really rub off on you. And also, you fine-tune your ability a lot when you're doing that. If you have somebody reading your pull requests and somebody who's peer reviewing your work, who is doing what you eventually want to do, or is at the skill level you want to be at, you are going to really ramp up your ability to learn and develop yourself.
Yeah, I think not being afraid to get uncomfortable, whether that's you're an expert at A, but now you're going to try B instead, and you're going to kind of stink at it at first and have to be less efficient and less impressive at doing things in B. But if you keep grinding at it, now you know both A and B. And then putting your ego aside as well and saying, all right, who's better at this than I am? What can I learn from them? Be nice, you know, bring in some bagels or something and, you know, see what you can learn from these folks who are right there doing what you want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agreed.
All right. Finally, why would you say technology is a great option for social mobility? Is this tie into coming from Western Maine?
Yeah. So the first reason really is a selfish reason. And that is that I want better technology, I want better software, I want better algorithms, and I want better medicine. I really want better advancements across STEM. And for us and for humanity to achieve that, we need more people coming into these fields and contributing to them. So if for just a selfish reason, I want to look at tech more as an opportunity for social mobility, because it will get more people into the field. But from, like you were saying, a more personal reason is for myself, coming from really very low economic status and coming from a background where it's exceedingly rare that somebody makes it into the middle class, and now being able to have a great career that I love and have joined the middle class, I see it as a unique opportunity to make that move. One of the major reasons that I say that is compared to other great careers that people could have, the barrier to entry here is significantly lower as far as economic resources go. The barrier to entry to do well in tech really is your motivation. So that is not obviously the only, but if you imagine somebody with no technical skills or technical background, you could purchase maybe $1,000 or $1,500 laptop to get a good computer. Then you could take a bunch of online tutorials to learn about different technical concepts. You could teach yourself, and then over the course of a year, 2 years, you can get really good at those. And the only cost after some of the certificate courses and whatnot is your effort and your time. Now, that is not a negligible cost, but it makes it achievable. Whereas if you look at a lot of other fields, so if somebody just wants to become a lawyer, you're not going to be able to enter the world of law without having completed a JD. And you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that. One of the things that I consider a lot in my current position is that if somebody comes to me with a master's degree in statistics and they have studied the topics, but they maybe don't have a lot of experience, or it doesn't look like they've had any major accomplishments. And I put that resume beside the resume of somebody who doesn't list educational credentials, doesn't list a degree, but they list a few major accomplishments. Maybe they launched an app, maybe they've contributed to open source and they've done a good job with it. They link to a GitHub page of very high quality code and clearly original projects that took a lot of creativity. And then they maybe list a couple certificate programs where they went to Coursera and did a 10-month program on there that they spent $500 on. I'm probably more likely to hire the second person in light of the academic credentials. So where that gets us is having people understand that this is an opportunity. So the story I told about having a professor who finally made statistics seem interesting to me and connected the dots that that would be a great career I could go into and that I would really love. We need to get that communicated, and we need to make it obvious to people that those are options. So if I were to go back and teach high school in middle of nowhere, Maine, where I'm from, that would be my primary focus, I think, would be on technology. Probably particularly on web development, because web development you can have a great career in and the learning curve is a little bit lower. So learning JavaScript, learning HTML, even learning some of the backend stuff, I think is a little bit lower than some other fields of technology, but still a really great career that you can learn of maybe a year or two of applying yourself. This is something I think a lot about. And certainly as I move through my career, something I want to focus more on and trying to get more people opportunities and just the knowledge of how they can enter the tech industry, how they can enter data science, if that's something that they're interested in.
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything you said, right down to the web developer being a good way to get into the field. My only knock would be you could probably get by with an even cheaper laptop.
That is a good point. That is a good point. I think of it from a very data science standpoint where like you need to store a lot of data in memory. You need to have some more computational ability, but you are definitely right. I mean, web development, I don't know this for sure, but you could probably do it on a Chromebook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen courses and people doing that there for sure. So thank you very much, Matt, for joining us and sharing a lot of great insights with us today on Underserved.
Thanks a lot for having me. This was a lot of fun. Really appreciate it.
And we'll talk to everyone next time on the next episode of Underserved.